So now I want to take up in May the 25th, 1912, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So the soul who lives in the divine will is a soft object in the hands of Jesus. Soft object means malleable. We would use the term malleable. So malleable means that God can actually work with us. So Louisa says, this morning, my beloved Jesus, seeing me very oppressed, let me suckle from his heart. And then he told me, now notice, let me suckle from his heart. She's using an image that doesn't fit. Mm-hmm. Is that okay? Because the images of a child suckling from a breast.
Yeah.
And this is where you can misinterpret her writings.
Yes.
She's, we would say, allowed me to draw from his heart. Is the way we would express it. Okay. So Jesus said, my daughter, if one wants to make a hole in a hard object or give it another shape, that object would be ruined and shattered. But if it is soft and made of a malleable paste, you see where I got my word? One can make the hole or give it the shape destined without fearing that it might break. So putting a hole in a piece of putty is not a problem.
Yeah.
Putting it in a piece of iron, you've got to be very careful. And if one wanted to give back the original shape, that object would be ready for everything with no difficulty. That, in other words, you're malleable. Such is the soul who lives in my will. She is a soft object and I can make of her whatever I want. The next sentence is now this, now that, and now the other, which is not English. So, sometimes I would wound her, or I would embellish her. I might even enlarge her, or in one instant, I could remake her again. And the soul is ready for everything. She opposes nothing, and I must carry her in my hands, delighting in her continuously. So, put at the side of that, surrender. This is utter surrender that is being described. Surrender to God. So, May the 30th, 1912. For the soul who truly loves Jesus, there cannot be separation from him. Now, through all these writings, a very simple statement is made, and that is, love is union. Love is union. So if for someone who truly loves God, there has to be that union there at some level. And love forms their mutual rest. So continuing in my usual state, I felt oppressed because of the privation of my beloved Jesus. So I'm going to go on from that. He said, my daughter, when you are without me, now she cannot be without him because if the divine will leaves us, we disintegrate. Okay. We can only survive if the divine will is in us. We cannot be without him if we're in grace because the Lord indwells each one of us. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
So when he says to her, when you are without me, he's talking about the deprivation that she doesn't see him with her eyes. Okay. He said, make use of this very privation to double or triple, to increase a hundredfold your acts of love towards me. Now, what he's saying here is when you're not feeling wonderful about prayer and you feel you can't do it, that's the time when you multiply your prayers. Whereas we're inclined to do the opposite. We wait until we feel good about it and then we multiply the prayers. And he says, no, it has actually more value the other way around, because the other way around, you're showing much more trust in God. Okay. So you, when you have the deprivation, you increase your prayers a hundredfold in such a way as to form an environment all of love inside and outside of you in which you will find me. Now, God is love. 1 John 4:7. Okay. And Psalm 145:17. God only ever acts out of love. So if we don't have an environment of love in our relationship with God, there is no union. And you might say, how on earth could anybody be religious and not have a relationship with God? The thing is, millions have. In other words, they can go to church and they can attend services and they can say prayers, but the whole thing is outside of themselves. They are not interiorly communing with God. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Now, you get a very good example of that in the parable of the Pharisee and the publican. Now, that's Luke, what is it? I think it sounds like Luke 19, where you had this very religious man telling God that he was the most perfect man on the planet. And he was telling God also that the one at the door was nothing. But the one at the door was actually communing with God in truth. God be merciful to me, a sinner. He was actually connecting with God in truth. So you can, in fact, go through religious services without making the connection with God. And you can see it nowadays as well with people coming to church, for example, say at funerals or weddings, and they don't even know when to stand up or sit down mm-hmm. or when to say yes, I or no. They're not, there's no connection there. They're just attending a social thing. That's all. So there must be an environment, all of love, inside and outside of you, in which you will find me. You find him in love because he is love. Now, you've heard me say many times that the summary of the 36 volumes is divine will and love, because God is love and God is divine will. You will find me more beautiful and as though reborn to new life. In fact, wherever love is, there I am. Now, we used to sing that in Latin. Ubi caritas et amor Deus ibi est. Do you remember? Yeah. Ubi caritas et amor Deus ibi est. Do you remember it?
Yeah.
That was one of our favourite hymns in the past when we knew what we were doing in a church. Where there is love and charity, there is God, because God is love. Okay. So in fact, wherever love is, there I am. Therefore, for the soul who truly loves me, there can be no separation. That's 1 John 3:2. 1 John 3:2. Rather, we form the same thing. Now, that's John 14:20-21. We form the same thing, you in me and I in you. You see it there? We form the same thing. Because love seems to create me, to give me life, to nourish me and to make me grow. So when we have an environment of love inside of us, it enables him to be able to bilocate himself in us and to live his true life in us. In love, I find my center and I feel recreated, reborn. While I am eternal with no beginning and no end. But thanks to the soul who loves me, I enjoy love so much that I feel as though remade. That means given a new dwelling place on earth to live in. It's like every time they build a church for Jesus, they give him a new dwelling place to live. Every time we open our hearts in love to let him dwell in us in a deeper way, we're giving him a new dwelling place. So, furthermore, in this love, I find my true rest. That's because he is love. My intelligence rests in the intelligence of the one who loves me. My heart rests in the heart of the one who loves me. My desires, my hands and my feet, they rest in the heart of the one who loves me. In the desire that loves me, and the one who desires only me. Now, desires only me follows that surrender bit, that you're surrendered to him. And therefore, he is the primary relationship in your life. In the hands that work for me, in the feet that walk only for me. So, part by part, I go along resting in the soul who loves me. This is why you'll hear Louisa saying in various places in her writings, I fuse all of me in all of him. Okay, and a very quick way of saying it is, Jesus, I fuse all of me in all of you all the time. So it's going on all the time. So part by part, I go along resting in the soul who loves me. And the soul, with her love, finds me in everything and everywhere. Now, that's the sure sign that the person is truly in union with God, that you find him everywhere and in everything, no matter whether it's a problem or whether it's a blessing. She rests completely in me. Now, to rest completely in him is Psalm 131. And it's only a few verses in it. My soul is like a weaned child on its mother's lap, and there's nothing more restful than that. Okay. She rests completely in me, and in my love, she is reborn, she is embellished, and she grows in an admirable way in my own love. Now, notice he said that he's reborn in us, and he finds a new dwelling in us, and we are reborn in him, and we find the dwelling in him. It's you in me, and I in you. That's your John 14. Now, that text is actually terribly important. And you're told that love makes love. And it is in love that we are reborn. Now, in other writings, Jesus often tells us that he has written everything into nature. For example, he intended you and me to be conceived in love. He intended you and me to be nurtured in the womb in love. He intended us to be born in love, to be nurtured in our early years with love, to be put on our feet with love. And then when we would reach the age of adulthood, that we ourselves would be able to enter into this union and pass love on to another generation. That's love being born, nurtured, coming to maturity, and then letting love be reborn and so on. He's saying the same thing on a spiritual level here. But you've already experienced it. And this is why you hear me saying often, most of the spiritual realities, the Lord has written them into our personal experience. Now, we experience them not on a perfect level, do you know what I mean? Because human beings are not perfect. But insofar as human beings can express this, you will have experienced it in some way. And so he's saying, now I want this reality to be for you permanently on the level of the Spirit in your union with God. Okay. June the 2nd, 1912. Only the things which are extraneous to Jesus can separate the soul from him. Now, that might sound a bit funny. Can I give you a heading to put on it? Prohibited baggage for your flight. Would you understand? Mm-hmm. You'll hear more in Drumantine. Because the Lord has given me a lot on this. Prohibited baggage. And when you see the list of prohibited baggage that I'll give you in Drumantine, you'll then ask me, what am I allowed? Because it'll be a bit like Ryanair. You can take your pajamas and your toothbrush. Because you're only allowed to bring love. That's the permitted baggage. Okay. So Jesus, Louisa continues in their usual state, and Jesus says, my daughter, when there is nothing in the soul which is extraneous to me, that is outside of God, and which does not belong to me, therefore it belongs to a different kingdom. Now you have the kingdom of this world, and you have the kingdom of Satan, and you have the kingdom of God. There isn't much choice. Okay. So if there's something outside of God, it can't enter into him. If it doesn't belong to me, he says, there cannot be separation between myself and the soul. So I want you to put Hebrews 12:14. Without holiness, no one will ever see God. That's one of the ones you write up on your fridge someday. I remember years ago writing that out on a little note and putting it on my fridge. And I said, Francis, without holiness, you will not see God. End of. Okay. So we can't, if we're going to have this union in love, you can't have stuff that belongs to the world or belongs to the kingdom of Satan. But people do have things like that without even realizing it. For example, Sometimes people go on holidays to exotic places and they'll bring back masks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I've had to deal with this with many people and say, did you bring back a mask from somewhere in Africa? Get rid of it fast, because it has been used in the occult. We have to be very careful with stuff you bring back from abroad. You need to know its source, you know, because you can be bringing trouble on yourself without realizing it. But something that's outside of him and doesn't belong to him also is unforgiveness. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Unforgiveness belongs to Satan's kingdom, and it belongs to the kingdom of the world as well. So I've given you a physical, a material example, and I've given you a spiritual example. Okay. I won't go on, but I just want you to see that you can have it at different levels.
Sorry,
even
Francis, that Hebrews 12,
yeah.
Without holiness, we
can't. No one will ever see God.
We can't see God.
Yeah. It actually says no one will ever see God. So Jesus says, even more I tell you, that if there is not a thought, affection, desire, or heartbeat which is not mine, either I keep the soul with me in heaven or I remain with her on earth. In other words, if there is true union during your lifetime on earth, your soul is actually living the life of the blessed in heaven. The only difference between someone truly living in union with God and in love and the blessed in heaven is that while you're on the earth, you have to merit, and therefore you have to carry the cross. You've got to make reparation for yourself and for others and so on. You have a job to do. And the people in heaven, their job is done. So they can't merit anymore. That's the only difference between us. If there are things outside of me, he said, this only can separate me from the soul. So over the years, I have been involved in helping people to really look at, is there anything material around you that separates you from God? Is there anything inside of you that separates you from God? Because if you got rid of all of that, he'll come in. It's like if I lift up the blinds, the light's going to come in. You don't have to have any ceremony about it. You just take away the blocks. And you remember Jesus at the tomb of Lazarus as well. He said, remove the stone. Mm-hmm. And if you remove the stone, the light of God will go in. And the miracle of God will come out. Okay. So so let's go to June the 9th, 1912. For the soul who does the divine will or lives in the divine and lives in it, there's no death and no judgment. Put VIP on this message. Now notice the no judgment. Okay, he said this, I didn't say it. Louisa said, I was feeling a little in suffering and I was saying to my beloved Jesus, when will you take me with you? Oh, please hurry, Jesus, let death cut this life of mine and unite me with you forever. So I want to give you a few scriptures there that will reflect this thinking. 2 Corinthians 5, 1 to 10. 2 Corinthians 5, 1 to 10. That is St. Paul asking to leave the tent of the body behind and go to heaven. And then he says, Lord, okay, I'll stay and finish the job you gave me to do. You still have him wanting to do it in Philippians 1, 20 to 26. And again, agreeing to stay on the earth because it's God's will for him. And I want to give you the book of Sirach or Ecclesiasticus, chapter 2, which explains why you have to suffer on the earth. And therefore, chapter 2. And it explains why you have to suffer on the earth. And therefore, it's very important to read it. Because sometimes people think, well, I got a poor hand of cards given to me. You know what I mean? Or I'm just unlucky. You know, it's not that at all. You have a job to do on the earth, and the circumstances of your life actually give you the opportunity to do what God wants you to do.
Can I ask a question?
Hold on to the question a little later. So Jesus said, my daughter, for the soul who does my will and lives of my volition, we would say lives from or out of my volition, there's no death. Death is for one who does not do my will, because she has to die to many things. Now, notice that death is used here in a very special way. When we bring up the subject of death, we often think of a funeral. But he's not talking about that. He's saying that in order to reach this union with God, we have to die to all kinds of things. The world, the flesh and the devil, and the self more than anything else. So if we're already living in the divine will, there's no death, because you can't get to living continuously in the divine will unless the ego has finally given in. Okay? Death is for one who does not do my will, because she has to die to many things, to herself, to her passions and to the earth. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. So they're all deaths. And in order to do that, to let these deaths happen, then you have the resurrection to the new life and the resurrection to love and the resurrection to living in the divine will. And that's why living in the divine will is called the life of the resurrection. But one who does my will has nothing to die to. She's already used to living in heaven. Living in heaven is living in love and living in union with God's will, divine will and love. For her, it's nothing other than laying down her remains. That means what's left over. Like one who would lay down the clothes of a poor one to wear the garments of a queen in order to leave exile and take possession of the fatherland. Now, the fatherland is what we call heaven. The soul who does my will is not subject to death, and she receives no judgment. Okay. Her living is eternal. That which death was supposed to do, love has done in advance, and my will has reordered her completely in me in such a way that I have nothing for which to judge her, and therefore remain in my will, and when you least expect it, you'll find yourself in heaven. Okay, now there's an enormous amount has just been said to you, and the Lord is going to go over it again and again and again and again in the higher volumes to explain it more and more. But let's do a little bit. What is the judgment after death? The judgment is on sin. Okay. Someone living in the divine will has given up sin. The judgment is on rebellion against God. Person living in the divine will has long since surrendered to God. The judgment is on anything that separates you from God. But the person living in the divine will has gone to war with sin and self and the passions and the world and all the rest of it. So as Jesus says here, you have already experienced death and you've done the judgment yourself. You've said, I am not going to let the passions dominate me. I am going to surrender to God. So that's me making a judgment on my own passions. When I decide to lay down my ego before the throne of God, you can't do it all at once without a miracle. Most of us have to do it 102 million times. When you finally lay down the last piece of the ego before the throne of God, judgment is over. Because you're now living as God intended you to live. That is, in union with his will and in love. And therefore you will carry out the mission that he's given to you. Is that all right? That's what he means by love has done it. You've done it because you love him. And because love has done it, he has reordered us. Now, he tells us in these writings very clearly that sin is the only disorder. Sickness isn't. Sickness is a result of sin. It's the effects. Okay. Sin is the only disorder. So supposing I've had a terrible accident and I've lost an arm and a leg and I die without the arm and the leg, that's not disorder to him. It's no bother to him giving you back an arm and a leg if you needed it. So that's not disorder. Disorder is sin only. That's what disintegrates your soul. Okay. So the soul is reordered completely in me in such a way that I have nothing to do with which to judge her. I think it's absolutely fantastic. Okay. So June the 28th, 1912. The soul who lives in the divine will is a heaven. Now I want you to ring that bit because now you're hearing something else. The soul who lives in the divine will is a heaven in which Jesus is the sun and his virtues are the stars. Now, this image that the soul is a heaven, we have to take it on board because he's going to elaborate on it in the higher volume. It's the lower tap. He's going to elaborate on it more and more and more as we go into the higher volumes. So we have to get the idea, what is a heaven? Unfortunately, we say the heavens, meaning the planets and the stars. But when we say heaven, we mean where God lives. Okay. Now, he's saying that a soul who lives in the divine will is a home for him. Now, God's home is what we call heaven. Is that okay? So therefore, I become a heaven for him. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And then using the image of the planets outside of us in the Milky Way, he says that the virtues in this heaven are like the stars. And they're taking their illumination from the sun. And he is the sun. Now, the very interesting thing is that if you go to the book of Revelation, chapter 21 and 22, you get the description of the New Jerusalem. And you're told that there's no earthly light in the New Jerusalem, that Jesus is the light. He is the sun. And that all the people living in the New Jerusalem are all living in God's will. So they're all, this is God's heaven on earth, the New Jerusalem. So notice you have the New Jerusalem in the individual soul. And you also have it in the church. And you also have it in the world because we're the church, each one of us. Is that okay? So Jesus said, my daughter, the soul who does my will is heaven. That's heaven for him. But heaven without the sun and without the stars, because I am the sun and the stars which embellish this heaven are my own virtues. That's Revelation 22, 23. How beautiful is this heaven, such as to enamor whomever can know it. And much more am I enamored as I place myself like the sun in the center of this heaven. And I keep darting through it continuously. Now, what he means by that is the sun is sending its light all over the earth all the time. So he's saying the sun is darting its earth, darting its rays. Yeah, towards the earth. Okay. So that makes Jesus the light of the world. John 8, 12. He's our light. And it very specifically says in Revelation 21, 22, that he is the light for the church. And John 9, 5. Both of them are saying that Jesus is the light. And I keep darting through it continuously with new light, with new love and with new graces. Now, when you get up to the higher volumes above volume 20, you're going to hear Louisa saying very, very often that she's in this immense space and there's nothing but light everywhere. And so she's trying to describe what it is like to be in this heaven. Is that okay? And unless we have taken it on board in these earlier volumes, when you come to it in the higher volumes, you say, oh, my God, this is language I don't understand. Okay. And so what happens in these writings is that the Lord gives you the seed message at an earlier volume. So, and then he begins to build on it. Okay. So here's we become his heaven or his home. How beautiful it is to see this heaven if the sun shines. That is, when I manifest myself and caress the soul, filling her with charisms. Now, my book has a wrong spelling there. It says charismas. Knock out the A. It's charisms. Do you see it?
It's correct here.
Okay, that's fine. So, in other words, he's saying you enjoy this experience when I manifest myself to you and you're getting obvious graces. So, you know, I'm giving you stuff and you're getting all these charisms. I embrace her, I touch her with love, and I faint and I rest in her. Psalm 132, verse 8. My soul faints. It doesn't necessarily mean a medical faint. Do you know what I mean? It means you're very deeply affected. All the saints gather around me while I rest. They're amazed in watching this heaven in which I am the sun. So this heaven is your own soul, in case you've forgotten. In which I am the sun, and remain ecstatic at this prodigious portent, because neither on earth nor in heaven can one find anything more beautiful and more delightful for me and for everyone. That's what he means by it's his heaven on earth. Our souls, when we live in the divine will, makes a heaven for him. So we actually make him happy, which is absolutely amazing, isn't it? Now, how beautiful this heaven is, that's the soul, if the sun hides. So this time, you're not actually perceiving the presence. That is when I deprive her of me. But at that point, John 20, I think it's 23, I'm not sure. I'll just give you the example, then you can find it. It's Jesus speaking to Thomas. And he said, blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. Okay, so I just don't remember the verse. Is that all right? So that's the sun hiding. Blessed are those who have not seen and still believe. Oh, how the harmony of the stars can be admired. In fact, the air of this heaven is not subject to clouds, showers, storms, because the hidden sun is hidden in the center of the soul. That's the indwelling of the Trinity in the soul. And its heat is so burning as to destroy clouds, showers and storms. That means that the love that this person has for God is actually so great that you don't have the depressions and the melancholies and the other stuff that other people are pulled down with so frequently. The air of this heaven is always calm, serene and sweet smelling. Now, one of the signs, and I give you this for your discernment, of a person in a stable, loving relationship with God is that they're calm and peaceful. Okay. And the stars which shine most brightly in it are perennial peace and endless love. You see, I just gave it to you in my way. So beside that, I want you to put Philippians 4:7. Philippians 4:7, the peace that passes all understanding and guards the heart and the mind in Christ Jesus. Now, whether the soul is hidden in the sun and the stars disappear, or the sun is hidden in her and the harmony of the stars appears. Now, the stars, don't forget, are the virtues. Okay. This heaven is beautiful in every way. This heaven is my contentment, my rest, my love, my paradise. And that's why in earlier volumes you heard Jesus saying to Louisa, when he would be giving her information about chastisements that needed to happen and all the rest of it, he'd say, I'll be on the earth, but in you. Because she was giving him the paradise on earth, because everything in her was in harmony with him. Okay, but he said a number of times that if he had to come down to the earth and not have someone like Louisa, he'd be more inclined to finish us off. So July 4th, 1912. The divine will must be the sepulchre of the soul. By thinking about herself, the soul escapes from the divine life. Now, we've just been talking about complete surrender and complete union. So now he comes at it from a slightly different angle, just to make sure that you got the point. Now, why should the divine will be the sepulchre of the soul? It's because he's already said that for someone living in the divine will, death has already taken place. You've let the passions and the sins and the bad habits and blah, blah, blah go. And you've also surrendered the ego. So you enter into the divine will to stay permanently. That's why he's using the term sepulchre now, because bodies are put in permanently, do you know what I mean? And why you'll hear Louisa in the higher volume saying, but there's no way out of this. I can't see any way out of this. Now, how can you actually slide down from this great height? By thinking about herself, the soul escapes. Okay. So here we're talking about death and resurrection. So this morning, after communion, I was saying to my beloved Jesus, to what state I've reduced myself, it seems that everything escapes me, suffering, virtues, everything. And Jesus said, my daughter, what is the matter? Do you want to waste time? Do you want to go out of your nothingness? Oh, put the big nothingness up there. Stay in your nothingness. Because if you, the nothingness is the safe place in the divine will. And if you stay in your nothingness, nothing's going to go wrong. He's going to mind you, because that nothingness will flow in his allness. Okay? He said, do you want to go out of your nothingness? Stay in your place, in your nothingness, so that the all may keep its place in you. So if the nothing stays in its place, the all can take its place, and the nothing and the all can become one. But if the nothing goes out of its place, then everything goes out of sync. And that's because we have free will and we can make decisions to get out. Know, however, that you must die completely in my will. Now, we're all in the business of trying to live in the divine will. The little word, the dangerous word here is completely. I remember hearing, and I don't listen to music, I don't like what they call music nowadays, but I accidentally heard a bit of a song that some young man was singing. It must have been when I hit a station. I didn't know I was going. And what he was singing was, when they say it's all over, it's not over completely. And he kept on repeating this all the time. I said, you poor soul. You know, it's all just lament. Do you know what I mean? But the problem with us is that we will give ourselves to the Lord, but not completely. It's the completely is the problem. And that is that you reach a point where you are given and that's it. You're not going to go back. You're not going to go back. At that point, you can sing, He is Lord, He is Lord. So you must die completely in my will. You must die to suffering, to virtues and to everything. I know you're going to say, no, that sounds like a contradiction in terms. How can you die to suffering? We don't really have much control over it. Now, he's talking to Louisa, who thought for a long time that in order to do her job as a victim soul, that she needed to be carrying the cross or being crucified or whatever. And then Jesus said to her eventually, look, it's not the suffering. Yes, we're using that for reparation for the church and the world. Yes, we're using it. But the suffering hasn't got a value in itself. It's only suffering in the divine will if God actually wants it. And the same with the virtues. You know, I could be an atheist and I could be trying to be the most upright person on earth and giving the most upright responses to absolutely everything. That's not virtue. A robot could be programmed to do the same thing. You know what I mean? And so he says, don't concentrate on your own sanctity. Don't concentrate on you growing in holiness, because that's the other spirituality, the spiritualities before the divine will, where a person works out their salvation in fear and trembling and where they work for their own sanctity. But when you enter the divine will, you're not working for yourself at all. You're surrendering completely to the Lord. And so whether you're virtuous or not virtuous, is not what you are actually going after. You will live in love because He is love. And you will live in the divine will because He is the divine will, and we're living through Him, with Him, for Him. Everything is Him. Am I making sense? So the concentration is not on ourselves at all. Not at all.
I heard a priest saying, it's not the suffering that makes the martyr, it's the cause.
He says, my will must be the tomb of the soul. That's the complete surrender. So in case you misunderstand tomb, will you say, put complete surrender on top of that? Because they're using language that they understand, and a century later we mightn't. Okay. And just as in the tomb, one's nature is consumed to the point of disappearing completely, and through that very consummation, it will rise again. That's on the last day, to new and more beautiful life. In the same way, the soul, buried in my will as though inside a tomb, will die to suffering, to her virtues, to her spiritual goods, and will rise again in everything in the divine life. Because what he wants is that if I am to live correctly in the divine will, everything of Francis has to go. And everything of Jesus has to take over. So it's not my virtues, it's the divine virtues. It's not my will, it's the divine will. It's not my mission, it's the divine mission. Everything is him, everything is him. That's why you're living the life of the blessed. Because in heaven, they're living only for God. They're not thinking of themselves at all. They're only living for his glory and praise and all the rest of it. And so in the divine will, we learn to do that while we're still alive. And actually, the saints in heaven would envy us, if envy was possible in heaven, that we have this opportunity to do this before we die. Because they weren't given this opportunity. Ah, my daughter, it seems that you want to imitate the mundane. Now, he means the worldly. I wouldn't think that's Jesus' mistake. It's the translator. Okay. Who tend to what is temporal and what ends. In other words, it's just very short-lived. While they take what is eternal into no consideration. And you see, in the divine will, it's the exact opposite. We take everything that's eternal into total consideration. My beloved, why do you not want to learn to live only of my will? Why do you not want to live only of the life of heaven, even while being on the earth? Now, he's saying that to Louisa, not for Louisa's sake. It's not her problem. But all of this teaching is completely new to the priests who are working with Louisa. And the questions are coming from them. And the reason why Jesus is allowing this dialogue is that a century later, and the centuries that come after us as well, they need the questions answered. Is that okay? Because the Lord knew that none of us were going to have a spiritual director. And so he had to answer our questions for us. My will is love. Do you see it there? The divine will and love. There's the summary of the 36 volumes. My will is love. And one that never dies. It's eternal. To use Tony Hickey's expression, infinite, perfect and eternal. Okay? Therefore, my will must be your sepulchre, because my will, Francis's will, can't get into heaven. Francis has got to hand over and go into heaven with the divine will. And love, notice the capital L, is the lid that must lock you and seal you in, giving you no more hope to get out. So divine will and love is actually what completes our transformation into God. And besides, every thought that regards oneself, even about virtues themselves, is always gaining for oneself and running away from the divine life. Okay. I want to give you 2 Corinthians 10:5, and it's a very important text. 2 Corinthians 10:5, where St. Paul says that every thought must be captured and given to Christ. You know that one, don't you? Mm-hmm. Every thought. And that's very easy until you try it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of thoughts that don't want to be captured. Mm-hmm. Or you might say to yourself, ah, well, in a few minutes now, you know. Every thought, he says. So if you really wanted a very severe discipline, try every thought. Handing over every thought, and you won't know what discipline was until then.
And the
It's utterly amazing how many thoughts go through our heads.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he says, every thought that regards oneself, even about virtues themselves, is always gaining for oneself and running away from the divine life. And if the soul thinks only about me, which is the opposite, you see, and what regards me, she takes divine life into herself. So anything that enhances Francis lowers the divine will. Anything that enhances the divine will lowers Francis. It's either one or the other. The two won't mix. While if the soul thinks only about me and what regards me, she takes divine life unto herself, and by taking the divine life, she escapes the human and takes all possible goods. Now, escapes the human does not mean you cease to be human. And it does not mean that you stop doing human acts. It means you stop staying at a low level of activity, that your activities are coming from a much higher plane. Is that okay? So let's just take a very mechanical example. It's the pilot breathing and walking on the ground and the pilot breathing and walking in an aeroplane. The breathing and the walking are both human activities. They're on very, very different planes. Okay. So the Lord wants us to stop operating merely at the human level and let all our thoughts, words, actions, movements, steps, everything be transferred onto the higher plane. Because then every thought, word, action, movement, step that we have affects every other soul, past, present and future, for their redemption and salvation. That's major.
Mm.
You know, so it means that your life is so rich in meaning that you can't comprehend it yourself. You know. So July the 19th, 1912, attentiveness to the teachings of Jesus makes the soul's refrigerating breath reach him also through others. I love the refrigerating breath bit. Love must stand alone. Okay. Now, just notice how many of these messages are on love, because you can't have the divine will without understanding love somehow. Sorry, would somebody flick the second switch and you'll have more light here. See it behind you. Thank you. I don't know how I forgot. Sorry about that. Louisa said, this morning, as I was in my usual state, blessed Jesus came. My daughter, he said, I feel your breath and I feel refreshed by it. Your breath gives me refreshment, not only when I am near you, but also when others speak of you and of the things said by you for their good. Through them, I feel your breath and I delight. My refreshment is repeated and I say, my daughter sends me her refreshment also through others, because if she had not been attentive in listening to me, she could never have done good to others. Now, the scary bit about that for me is that he's aware of all your thoughts and all your words and all your actions. And the even scarier bit is that when you go to the book of Revelation, it's also in the book of Daniel, that there is a book of life in which everything is recorded. I remember when my dad told me that as a child, I used to have nightmares. I said, he'll open this book and every single thing about me, everybody on the planet will know. It's actually, God knows, the rest of them wouldn't be bothered. they have their own worries as to what will come out about them. So it's that God knows it. Everything is known. And so this is either a terrifying thought or a consoling thought. And I want you to put Psalm 139 there. Psalm 139 says, you know my thoughts before I think them, my words before I say them. This knowledge is too wonderful for me. But if you're an unbeliever, it would make you hate God and say, Big Brother is watching. you'll get different reactions to this. But for a person who's trying to love God, no matter how much they fail, This is very consoling because you say, he knows I'm trying. He knows that no matter how often I fail him, I still come back. And as you, as a parent, you know that the important thing is for the child to come back. Not that the child fell or that the child said something wrong. Okay. That's why Jesus said he finds refreshment. In other words, people are helping one another by talking in love to each other. Okay. So therefore, she's still the one who sends me this good, he said. So I love you more and I feel compelled to come and converse with you. And then he added, true love must stand alone. Now, any lover will tell you that. They don't tolerate a third in the relationship, do they? What person tolerates a third in a marriage? Nobody. Because love is actually jealous. It's terribly important. Now, I want to give you some scriptures for love is jealous. God's love is jealous. Exodus 20, verse 5. Exodus 34, verse 14. Deuteronomy 4, verse 24. And Deuteronomy 5, verse 9. So true love must stand alone. When it leans on somebody else, even a holy or a spiritual person, it nauseates me. Now, what he's talking about there is that I might be trying to have a relationship with God. But supposing this person is my spiritual director and I'm leaning on this person far too much for his thoughts and his words and his direction and so on. The Lord is saying, but you're not leaning on me. And it's very, very clear from the writings of Luisa Picaretta that even though she had a string of priests looking after her, she relied entirely on the Lord for everything. That's very clear in Thérèse of Lisieux and the other saints as well. No matter what priests were there as their spiritual directors, they were leaning completely on the Lord. And so we have to be careful that we don't put somebody up as what I call a guru. In other words, they're the model, we follow them. The thing is, God didn't make you like that person. And from each one of us, God wants a completely unique response. So I've been emphasizing this all the time, because if he didn't want a completely unique response from each one of us, why did he make us different? If he wanted the same old thing, all he needs are robots. Yeah. So while somebody might be teaching you or helping you or any other way, they're not the model. No matter what they do, they're not the model. Jesus alone is the model. And then he gives us our Blessed Mother as the other model. So when it leans on somebody else, even a holy or a spiritual person, it nauseates me. And instead of contentment, I feel bitterness and bother, he said. In fact, only when love stands alone can I have lordship and do whatever I want with the soul. And this is the nature of true love. Okay. And when it does not stand alone, one thing can be done, something else can't. It's hindered lordship, which does not give me full freedom, and therefore love feels uncomfortable and constrained. A musical that you probably remember from years ago, there was a song in it which said, with me it's all or nothing. And the reason why I remembered it, I said, Lord, that fits you perfectly. You either give yourself to him or you don't. But you see, the mistake that we make is that we'll go a certain distance and not go the whole way. And if you go a certain distance and not the whole way, you'll never be truly happy. It's only when a person is completely given. I have a lovely picture inside. I'll show it to you eventually from a saint you probably never heard of. Saint Madeleine de Clercq. I presume you never heard of her. And she said, I think she was the foundress of the Sisters of the Sacred Heart or something like that. She said, the surrendered soul has found paradise on earth. That's what Jesus is talking about here. But it's only when you're completely given. You know this yourselves in a marriage relationship, that if a person hasn't given themselves completely to that marriage relationship, the thing, darn thing doesn't work, does it? There's always something blocking the flow that should be in the relationship. Well, that's what Jesus is talking about as well. And again, you see, he's written the knowledge into our lived experience. So I'll just do one more with you. July the 23rd, 1912. The heart must be empty of everything. Now, for us Westerners, heart usually is a symbol of love. The word heart here is used in the same way as it's used in the scriptures. And it means your inside person, the real you, your persona. Finding myself with my beloved Jesus, I was lamenting to him because in addition to his privations, I also felt my poor heart insensitive, cold, indifferent to everything. So she was going through one of the dry periods. As if it no longer had life. What a pitiful state mine is. And even so, I myself am unable to cry over my misfortune. Since I myself am unable to have compassion for myself, you have compassion for this heart. You, Lord, we would say, please have compassion for this heart, which you have loved so much and which you intended so firmly to receive. So Jesus responded and said, my daughter, do not afflict yourself for something that deserves no affliction. This dryness in prayer is perfectly normal for us all. It doesn't deserve attention. You just get on with it. Instead of having compassion for these laments for your heart, I am pleased and I say to you, rejoice with me because I have made a complete purchase of your heart. In other words, it's completely given. And since you no longer feel anything of your very contentment and the life of your heart, I alone come to enjoy your contentment and your very life. You must know that when you do not feel anything from your heart, I draw your heart into mine. Now, one of the things that we make a mistake about in prayer, the Lord taught me very clearly in a particular incident that happened years ago. I got up to pray about 6 a.m. and it was January. It was ferociously cold. I got a very clear instruction not to put the heat on. So I emphasized it was January and it was cold. And so I sat just in front of a crucifix to do the prayer. And I think it was the longest hour I ever lived. I must have looked at my clock at least 10 times. And at one stage I said, the watch must have stopped. And I went out to check and unfortunately the clock outside agreed with the watch. I was never so dry and absolutely unable. I couldn't think. I couldn't think a decent thought if I was paid. And it was this painful dryness that you hear Louisa talking about quite frequently. So anyway, at the end of the hour, I looked up at the crucifix and I said, I hope you got something out of that. I am frozen cold and I'm bored. And it was one of the times he actually spoke. And he said, this time it was all for me. He said, when I give to you, you enjoy it. And when you give to me, you don't. Now, which of us loves each other the most? Never again complained about prayer. It's all the same to me, whether it's dry or wet, if I can use the two expressions. He said, when I am giving to you, I'm giving you grace, I'm giving you consolation, I'm giving you insight, I'm giving you, you enjoy it thoroughly because you're receiving. But he says, sometimes I decide it's your turn to give. Hence, I was given specific instruction not to make myself warm, not to get any help, not to do this, not to do that, and just sit in front of a crucifix for a solid hour at 6 o'clock in the morning. And it was the longest hour I ever lived. But he was trying to teach me this, what he's teaching her. Is that okay? So what he's trying to say to us is that if you have a period of dryness in prayer, don't even bother about it. Just continue as normal. But if you could remember that it's his turn to receive, you'll give it to him better than I gave it to him that time. Because I've never bothered since. It doesn't matter to me whether the prayer is difficult or it isn't. Sometimes I just say, oh, it's your turn. But once you know it's his turn, it's not going to be the same problem. Do you know what I mean? But if we expect to feel the prayer all the time and feel good about the prayer, notice the feel thing, then it's still us. And he's trying to get us to give. Okay. So you must know when you don't feel anything from your heart, I draw your heart into mine and I keep at rest in sweet sleep and I enjoy it. If you do feel it, then the enjoyment is together. If you let me do, in other words, give me the freedom to be God, you know what I mean? After I have given you rest in my heart and enjoyed from you, I will come and rest in you and I will make you enjoy the contentment of my heart. So whether you have the dryness or the consolation, neither goes on forever. There's this normal fluctuation of light and darkness and night and day and so on. Ah, my daughter, this state is necessary for you, for me and for the world. In other words, there's reparation in prayer as well. For you, if you had been awake, you would have suffered very much in seeing the chastisements. That's Amos 3:8. The Lord always tells the prophet ahead of time. You would have seen the chastisements that I'm sending now and the others which I will send. Therefore, it's necessary to put you asleep so as not to make you suffer too much. It's necessary for me. How much I would have suffered had I not made you content, because she'd keep at him to keep changing it, you see. Had I not condescended to what you wanted, and since you would not permit me to send chastisements. So it was necessary to put you to sleep. In certain sad times, with the necessity of chastisements, it is necessary to choose ways in the middle in order to be less unhappy. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. So whatever the Lord chooses for us is actually right. It's necessary for the world. If I wanted to pour myself out with you and make you suffer as I once used to do, and therefore making you content by sparing the world its chastisements, faith, religion, salvation, look at it, would be banished even more from the world, and it's only 1912. Isn't that something? Because at this particular stage, Marxist atheism was absolutely blasting out onto the world. Ah, my daughter, let me free, whether I have to keep you awake or asleep. Did you not tell me to do whatever I wanted? Of course, we do tell the Lord he can do whatever he wants, so long as it's within what we want. Do you perhaps want to withdraw your word? She said, never, 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 it's okay. So then he said, listen, my daughter, it is perhaps that some thought, affection or desire which is not for me has entered into you. Now, here's a bit of discernment for you. Because sometimes when we're having difficulty in prayer, it's because some little thing has intercepted and we just haven't noticed. He says, has some thought, affection or desire which is not mine has entered into you. If this were the case, you should fear. If it's not the case, then it's a sign that I keep your heart in mine and I make it sleep. The time will come, it will come, when I will have it wake up. And then you will see that you will take the attitude you had before. And since you will have been at rest, this attitude will even be greater. And then he added, I make souls of all kinds. Now, this emphasizes what I said a few minutes ago. I make the ones sleepy with love. I make the ones ignorant of love. I make the ones crazy of love. And I make the ones learned of love. How's that? And of all this, do you know what interests me the most? That everything is love. Whether you're learned or simple or whatever. Isn't that gorgeous? Everything else which is not love is not worth even a glance. Isn't that absolutely brilliant? So we'll leave it there for tonight.